going to be talking about lifestyle changes, lifestyle choices for the next three classes. And when I came to the group in the beginning of your time to talk about electives, I didn't say a lot about what I would do. And as I've been thinking about it over time, I realized that I had something in the back of my mind that I wanted to do about lifestyle change and choice. And it kind of took me by surprise that that's how I'm approaching it is the way I'm approaching it, and yet it makes perfect sense. I began to look at other resources in the last few weeks in order to see what other people had done about around lifestyles. And I noticed that there are lots and lots of tapes at Holden and books to read about lifestyles. The Schramm's tapes on lifestyles and things that make for peace, and Ron Sider's tapes on rich Christians in a hungry world, and lots of books we have in the library and the bookstore. And I thought, these are terrific, and I'm gaining a lot reading these and listening to these, but this is not how I'm going to talk about lifestyles. And what I realized I'm going to talk about for the three sessions is more the internal psychological effects and dynamics that work on us and that we use to make change. That there's more to lifestyle choice than deciding what our values are and deciding what our plan of action is. There's a lot that goes on emotionally at the feeling level, and also old learnings and attitudes that we have developed over time that I think affect the choices we make and whether we're capable of making the choices we want to. So that's going to be my foundation for my approach, and it's a little different than what is usually talked about at Holden. But I realize that I think it's a nice complement to what's usually talked about at Holden, and probably if you put it all together, then you got enough to go on. So I'll refer back to some of these other tapes that that I listen to that I would really suggest that you listen to likewise. So the way that we'll proceed in these classes will be I'll do some presenting and ask you to do some thinking and talking with each other and then sharing with a large group, and I hope that we can get some conversations going too. The word lifestyle always throws me for a loop, and as a college counselor, the career counselors were always talking about lifestyle, and it was just a drag. I thought, what are they talking about? It seemed like too pop a term to me. You know, it must mean you're going to live the high life, or I don't know. Just as too pat. But it is the word that most of us use to mean something about that pattern of living that we have, our life way, our life, the outward signs of how we live and what. And so I'm going to use the word until we find something a little better. I think it can be helpful. I've taken a definition from this manual, A Covenant Group for Lifestyle Assessment, which is in both the library and the bookstore, and it's from what's called the Eco-Justice Task Force, funded by the Presbyterian Hunger Program. And it's a manual of 12 sessions for people to assess their lifestyles, particularly in a church-related group. Their definition of lifestyle, I think, is pretty good. They say that lifestyle are those patterns of living that include the ways in which we spend our time, energy, and money, and the kinds of relationships and roles we take on. So, lifestyles are those behaviors, the patterns of behaviors that we have about how we expend our energy and the kind of roles we enter into, all lumped together. We say this is my lifestyle. I'd like to go with that definition unless there's something that seems very inadequate about it for you, or you would want to add something to it to make it make a little more sense. Can we live with it for a while? Mm-hmm. Okay. I'd like you to think about yourself for a minute. Patterns of living that includes the ways in which we spend time, energy, or money, and the roles that we take on. Think for yourself about a pattern of one pattern of living that you have.
Give us an example.
No, I'm not going to write this minute. But I am going to add a clarification. Usually these patterns of living reflect our priorities, our values, our commitments. Those things we think are important or that we truly care about. So they're reflections of our values, commitments. Priorities. I will give you an example. There's a pattern I have in my life. It's small, but it's a set of behaviors, which is that I make lists for just about everything I do. And it's a part of my life. I generally make them first thing in the morning and at the end of a week and have these lists and I cross things out. And what I realize they reflect for me is a value of order, organization, structure. I tend to feel much more free within a structure than I do when there isn't one. So that would be an example of a very small pattern of behavior, but it's a consistent one. What about you? Can you think of something that's a pattern of behavior for you, and what does it reflect?
I work nights.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what does it reflect for you?
It reflects my attitude that if I'm going to have to work in a hospital setting, I'm going to do it when there's very few people there. People like doctors and lab technicians and just about all the hubbub is not there. Generally.
You're not referring to patients.
No, I'm not. Patients. Patients are just as sick at night as they are in the daytime, but there isn't a bunch of other personnel and stuff going on. Mm-hmm.
So you're a night worker, that would be a reflection. That's part of your lifestyle. Somebody else. What's a pattern you have?
I always like to clean house and have a good bath and hair washing on Saturday, but I like to be really new to start Sunday morning. And I suppose that reflects the value that Sunday is an important day, and I suppose some order or structure.
Maybe that goes back to your childhood.
Oh, sure.
Mm-hmm. You all used a tin tub.
No.
Saturday night bath.
I was before you.
Uh-huh.
Others?
Just a tiny, insignificant one. But a pattern that I guess I've had for years is that I have 3 or 4 or 5 books that I'm reading at the same time, usually, and I think that reflects it. That I value lots of different things, variety and change, and don't like to wait till I've finished one because there's something else that's just as interesting to be looking at.
Mm-hmm. Keep it spicy. What about... Go ahead.
I keep long-term relationships alive with many of the people that I don't see very often, but I work at keeping them alive by phone and mail. Is that I guess I treasure when there's been some intimacy, I treasure that long hang on.
Mm-hmm.
That's me alone for me.
Mm-hmm. Some of what we're talking about is the way we spend time and energy. What about money? What about anybody have a pattern that they can explain?
I tend to be real stingy except when it comes to fishing.
And then it all hanged out.
Yeah. My wife used to say it was like I was in a cult. I'd walk into a tackle store and my eyes would glaze over and hand them all my money.
What does that reflect?
It reflects my values.
Reflect our new priorities, values, commitments. That there's some mismatch. And now we want to make some change. think about your present lifestyle. Your present might be here at Holden for some, if you're here for a long time, or present might be Holden plus what's on either end of it. Think about your present lifestyle right now. Are there pieces of that that you want to change or that are going to change? Anybody? There's a few nods.
Well, when we very first started this in terms of lifestyle and patterns, right away I thought of when you're ready to share something, then when you added reflexive hours, you went to the next groups. And that was the automobile. I like pattern. It seems like it hinges around the car, the mobility, to be able to move and go places very freely that way. Yet it's one in terms I struggle with because of the sheer cost of buying one, maintaining it, and real big chunk of budget goes to transportation. And then with the understanding of problems that the automobile causes in terms of pollution. And so that's a what I would call a transition, I guess, sort of a life pattern and change. And my car is a wreck now, so I have to confront it. If I still want the mobility to get it, either fix it up or get a new one. And I just, you know, I threw in about $400 and I still only got a $50 car. So you kind of wonder there.
That's when you have to change or else not do it.
So it's kind of a real struggle.
Yeah. Can I make the assumption that most of us are in the process of making some kind of change in our lifestyle pattern? Is there anybody who isn't?
I can't remember ever not.
Yeah, right. Yeah, me neither. I think my mom wouldn't probably say that.
Yeah. Oh, my mom.
Would she?
I'll tell you something that's scary to me. This is the first time I've ever not had a place to go back to. I mean, I have plenty of places to go, but they're not mine.
That would be real different. Well, those are the kinds of things I hope we keep in mind during these three sessions. Think about ourselves. While I give you some information, and hopefully it will be helpful to you. There are a variety of reasons why we change our lifestyle, but I want to mention three that I think most of the causes for lifestyle change fall under. And I think when we understand what they are, it helps us a little more in knowing what we're dealing with. I think we make change for three basic reasons. Circumstances beyond our control force us into change, or we have some kind of need, dissatisfaction or discontent. We have some need that's not being filled, we can have all of these at the same time, or we have some kind of deep concern for the world beyond ourselves. And I'm going to explain each one of these in a little more detail. I think we change when circumstances beyond our control force us to. That is, we suddenly become ill, or someone in our life who's close to us dies, or suddenly our jobs are terminated. Those are beyond our control. They happen to us. We have to react to them. My moving to Holden for 9 months was my choice. so it wasn't a circumstance beyond my control. But the effect it had on a couple of close friends really threw their lifestyle, some of their lifestyle patterns, into a tizzy, because in a sense their best friend was gone. That's not what they wished, but she was out of the picture. And that meant a kind of regrouping about how are they going to spend time, who are they going to spend time with, and that kind of thing. So there was some upset for them that happened because somebody else was making a change. We also change because we have some sort of need that's not being met. I can talk about that in a couple of ways. I'm talking about inner needs. Abraham Maslow is a psychological theorist and practitioner. And he's that old model of the hierarchy of needs. You remember, most of you have heard that one. That we have a set of needs that start at the bottom of physiological needs to just be fed and clothed and have some shelter. And we move to feel need to feel safe with the world. We need to feel loved. We need to feel some esteem, some respect for what we do. And then he says we move on to what he calls self-actualization, which is the realization of all our potential. But what he basically says is that we have all those needs, and if we don't meet them, I can't spell physiological sideways, then we're dissatisfied, and we spend our energy trying to fill that need up, he says. So if we don't have enough food and shelter, that's how we spend our time, and we're discontent, dissatisfied at the very least, until we have that need met. He also says that once a need is met, there's some dissatisfaction until we move on to the next level. We feel a restlessness. There's something missing. We want more. Life isn't full. We move on to the next level. That, I think, gets into the kinds of things that Elizabeth O'Connor and Mary Schramm talk about when they talk about gifts, the need to act on our gifts, that if we don't act on them, if we don't discover them, they gnaw at us. They feel like this rock or this burning that just doesn't go away until we act on it. They don't leave us alone. And I think that's kind of what Maslow's saying, is we reach a plateau and then, what's going on? I feel restless. I gotta do something. So that's what I mean by need dissatisfaction. We're motivated to change because of it. And the third thing, and I think that this is something that we talk quite a bit about at Holden, is that we as human beings commonly feel, we do feel connected with the world, with the rest of the world, with the world outside of ourselves. We feel connected with each other. We feel some kind of response to the suffering of other people. We often call that compassion, the ability to suffer with someone else. And we do. And we hear about the suffering in the world in ways that we can't avoid. And we have a response as human beings that's natural and normal. We want to do something about it. We don't want it to continue. We ache. We hurt with everyone else. We call that a need for justice, a need for peace. It's a very real thing. In Joanna Rogers Macy's book, Despair and Personal Power in the Nuclear Age, she describes that as feelings of pain for our world are natural and healthy. She says, confronted with widespread suffering and threats of global disaster, responses of anguish, of fear, anger, and grief, and even guilt are normal. They are a measure of our humanity, and these feelings are probably what we most have in common. Just by virtue of sharing this particular planet and this particular time, we know these feelings more than any other generation. We are in grief together, and this grief for our world cannot be reduced to our private problems. These are beyond our private problems. They are in addition to them. Whatever personal griefs, frustrations, and anxieties we bear, this is in addition to it. Not to experience it would be a sign of intellectual and moral atrophy. But that is academic, she says, for I have met no one who's immune to this pain. Now, our society does all kinds of things to block us from acting on that pain, to divert it or distort it. When I was in the winter program when I spoke to the winter program last winter, I talked about that. I had two sessions on what happens in our society and what happens to us as humans when our society does not allow us to act on that compassionate feeling toward the world. And so I just listened to those tapes. And they're called peacemaking, but I think with what I prefer they were called were psychological aspects of peacemaking. So, I think these are probably the things that move us most often to look at our lives and to change. Does anybody see something that I've missed?
How do you see faith commitment related to that?
Well, number three I think might be part of it. I would see it undergirding all of those. In fact, the Covenant Group for Lifestyle Assessment say that any discussion about lifestyle or any reevaluation of lifestyle for a person of faith should come out of their understanding of their faith. So, and you'd see that in all those, I think. Did you have a specific thought?
No. I'm continually relating psychology to faith.
Good. I encourage you to do that while I'm here. That helps both. Okay, any other thoughts before I move beyond that? Now what we could do, but we're not going to do, but what we could do right now would be to start talking about what needs to change in the world. What is a justice lifestyle? What's a peaceful lifestyle? How do we meet our needs? And so on. And I'm not going to do that, but I'm going to suggest that you go to those tapes that I suggested from Mary and John and Ron Sider and anybody else that you can just go down the rack and say, I want to know more about evoking my gifts. I want to know more about why and how this world needs to change. And go listen to those. I've been listening to them, and they're very helpful to me. I hope you do too. But I think they can say it all a lot better than I can. And we need to listen and read and hear those ideas because they help motivate us and they help us create our visions, which is what we're going to talk about the next class, how we create our own visions. So if there's been one of those tapes you've been dying to listen to, you might want to go listen to it before next Tuesday. But I'm going to take a different twist. And I was kind of forcing myself not to. Like, oh, you don't want to talk about this, you want to talk about this. But I guess I did, because this is the way I went. And that is, I want to talk about why change is so hard to make. It seems that, at the very least, it creates an upset, if not a lot of strain and pain when we make it, even in the best of circumstances. And I guess as a person steeped in psychology, I would think that that's real critical to understand before people can make a move. So that's what I'm going to talk about from now till we're done. I'm not alone, however, in thinking like this. There's another book that's new to the bookstore called Here's Hoping by Jan Bodine, who was an LCA pastor and is now a peace educator in Minneapolis. And she says, this is my question, why is change so difficult? Here's her answer. What is change? Some changes occur in a moment, as in winning of a sweepstakes. Others in a few hours after meeting someone special. And still other changes take hundreds of years. Sometimes changes are positive, sometimes they're negative. Sometimes changes are obvious, sometimes others are hardly perceptible. Changes may require minimum work or an enormous effort. Often change is unexpected. Always change is a matter of timing. But every change involves a letting go of what has been, of what has been known, what may have worked in the past, and what has been adapted to. And I think it's that letting go that hurts. That's where the hurt is. Because what we're letting go of is a bit of ourselves. You know, a sort of popular way to put that would be letting go of our old self. And yet our new self isn't there yet to make it better or safe. And that really hurts. And it can be big or little, but it's like a little death. When Ray and I decided to get married a year and a half ago, it was so exciting to decide to get married. And we did it. We just said, well, yeah, I want to marry you, and you must marry me. And we were happy, and we knew that the timing was right, and we knew that, you know, this was the right person, and that we had good ideas. And, you know, I was 36, and I was ready, you know, to marry him, and I was real happy for about 3 days. And then I plunged into one of the deepest depressions I'd ever had for about a month. And I thought, whoa, where is this coming from? But actually, I didn't think that. I was just feeling miserable. But I had enough good sense at that point to talk to some people about it. And I knew that it didn't make sense, in that I had just made this wonderfully happy decision, and I was miserable, and that didn't go together, it seemed. So I did some thinking and talking about it. And what I realized I had done was I had made this decision that was going to make my life happy, and that did make my life happy, but I was experiencing a little death, and that was that I was no longer the daughter of my mother, as much as I was now going to be the spouse of this man. And it meant my loyalties were going to shift. That in a sense, I was losing that position that I'd had in my family. And I come from a very possessive family. And I didn't even realize that this was even going on in me, that at this, you know, it was so deep and so normal kind of in my life. I didn't even know that this would happen. But as soon as I made that decision to be committed to Ray, I felt like I lost my mom. And she did too. And we've had to grieve that change in our relationship and rebuild a different relationship together. And for me, it's been just the right thing to do, and it's felt wonderful, and my choice feels like the right one, and all of that business. But it was really devastating, because there was a loss. There's been a gain, but there was a loss. So I said to myself, I wonder if that's why it's taken me 36 years to decide to get married. You know, I don't want to face that, maybe. I don't think that's the only reason. But I think it was operating somewhere, and I just didn't realize it. So I guess that's an example of how there's pain in change, as much as there's gain in good things. And if you think about, I don't know if others of you have had similar kinds of experiences, but if you just take my example, if you think how difficult it is to make a change like that, think how much more difficult it is when we try to change society, when we try to change the world, when we try to change groups of people, when we wish the legislature would vote differently, when we wish our nation would think differently. And we try and we work to try to make that change. Imagine what we're trying to do and how difficult it is, particularly when we realize that as a nation, for instance, if we have always had some kind of military weapons defense, we have lived with it, we've adapted our society to it, we think it may be the thing that's working, it's ours. We're asking ourselves to try to change that. Imagine the upset. And I think, I'm not at all saying that it's impossible. I'm just saying, you know, let's look at some of the difficulties that go with it. And the reason, I guess, I want to say let's look at the difficulties is that if we don't look at the difficulties, at the pain, at the dark side, then we don't have all the energy we need in order to try to create the change. And Matthew Fox talks about the via negativa. Other people know about the dark side, and in the dark side is a lot of strength if we face it. T.S. Eliot, there's a poem in Matthew Fox, in Original Blessing, it was, something he said. I said to my soul, be still, and let the dark come upon you, which shall be the darkness of God. And Carl Jung has said, there is no birth of consciousness without pain. And any mother can tell you there's no birth without pain. Apollinaire, I don't know how to pronounce the name exactly, but he said, come to the edge, he said. They said, we are afraid. Come to the edge, he said. They came. He pushed them, and they flew. Like without moving into it, we can't move through it and out of it and into what's next. I think it happens when we do try to do political action, when we try to do personal change. So, I guess I'm going to talk some more about our feelings, particularly those feelings that are difficult for us to feel. Are you with me? Do you feel, you feel, is it tying together at all? Okay, let me know if I get too far afield. I guess what I want to talk about is despair, depression, and despondency. So the three Ds. I'm going to kind of lump them all together. When we despair about life or despair about things, we've lost hope. We've lost the desire for things to be better, or we've lost the expectation that they ever could be better. That's a hard place to be. When we feel that, we often feel sad most of the time. We feel unable to function fully. It might be difficult to concentrate. We might have psychosomatic reactions. Our stomach might ache. We might have headaches. We might find ourselves, our emotions are right on the surface. We want to cry frequently, or we find ourselves real irritable and snapping. Our feelings are full, but they're weighing us down. Those feelings can build up over time, and we find ourselves in that kind of situation. That often happens with need dissatisfaction. If there's a gift we know we have and we're not acting on it, or there's a need or an impulse and we're not acting on it, we can almost predict that pretty soon we're going to feel low and bad. I think when we have political activity in our lives and we're trying to change this area, number three, the concern for the world, I think it hits harder and faster. Not harder, but it hits quicker. And that's because we're trying to change other people. And when they don't change the way we want them to, it hits us like a real blow. Blow to the stomach, kind of. And it's the same feeling that we're losing hope. Often those feelings feel overwhelming, and that we are at the mercy of our feelings, and we get irritated that we even have this. Where's our control? And so on. And I think if there's one thing I want to say today to you to remind us, is that our feelings are there for a reason. They are fuel for change, for clear thinking. They are those things that cleanse us of what's wrong and brighten our thinking once they're out of us. But we need to have them, and we need to honor them. We need to be gentle with ourselves about them. We don't have to be victimized by them, particularly if we honor them and we understand why we're having them. So I'm going to say a few more words about that. Florida Scott Maxwell wrote a book called The Measure of My Days, and we have that. And she wrote it in her 80s. She was a psychotherapist and a person of faith, and she realized that people's despairing often came as a result of the kinds of expectations they carried about themselves and about their world. And I thought you might be interested in hearing what she said about those. She broke them down into four sets or kinds of expectations. Expectations of ideology, personal expectations, spiritual expectations, and communal. Let me explain each of them. We're going to go till about 12:15, by the way, because I planned an hour and 15 minutes and we started. So just to let you know where we're at. She says that expectations are limited expressions of our limited visions about what can be or what is. We can only have visions out of our own perspective, and just because of that, they've got to be limited. And we can only express those things in a limited way, just because of how we express. So, but we operate out of expectations all the time, those limited expressions of our visions. When our expectations don't get met, that can be quite disturbing, particularly if they come out of these categories. An ideological expectation are those expectations we have about the standards of the world, about the way things ought to be, the principles that we think should guide our lives. And we all have them, and we usually want to hold on to them. It makes life seem stable. So one example would be if an ideology is the belief that patriotism is very important, therefore I believe the United States is always right. And I want to hold on to that. There were lots of people during Watergate times and in Vietnam where they had that particular expectation crushed. And it was a time I saw as despair in the nation that we all felt, many of us felt, very despondent about that. We can have a belief or a standard about inclusive language and the struggle in the church around inclusive language. You know, there's got to be some bottom lines here. A bottom line might be God is male. I mean, that's it. Or a bottom line, We strive for that. We need that stability. When it's disturbed, it's very upsetting. And I think the way we counteract that as human beings, to help ourselves and be healthy about that, is from time to time to recognize what those ideologies are and allow ourselves some reevaluation of them without feeling like the world is going to pot, or I am, but that now I have new information. Now my vision is a little more expanded. Now I'm able to express that in a little better way. Maybe that standard needs to shift a little bit for me. But if we hold too strongly to them, we often feel crushed when it looks like it's changed. We also have personal expectations of ourselves. And that's kind of, I would describe that as coming to understand what our own limitations are. Physical, mental, intellectual, and so on. Those are often disturbing, and those can be real blows. I assume that I'm a compassionate person. And every time I act in a way that's not compassionate, it's a little shaky. And it makes me reevaluate who I am, what my potential really is around that, the ability to extend sympathy and empathy. Better to know than to pretend and not to know. I have friends who have been trying to become pregnant for years and years, and gone through all kinds of tests and finally found that they cannot. That kind of personal limitation, that personal expectation that they should have their own biological children and can't do that. Tremendously depressing for some people. Spiritual expectations. That's basically the expectation that somehow or other the divine is going to intervene. That we will do all we can, but somehow or other God is going to come and do what we are not able to do. Of course, in our way and with end result that we're hoping for. Jan Bodine has this statement in her book about God. I asked for help, None came. I turned away. I felt guilty for turning away. I asked for help with my guilt. None came. No. For some people, when their prayers don't get answered in the way that they think they should be, it can be a real feeling of alienation, of estrangement, a blow. And once again, it's that thinking through, what are my expectations? Are they realistic? Getting new information, enlarging our vision, thinking about it in a new way. And finally, we have communal expectations, and that's expectations we have of everybody else, not of us. And people disappoint us pretty often. And there again, it's, well, what does that mean? Either people are pretty disappointing, or my expectations don't quite fit what the reality is. And usually it's helpful to have a reevaluation of expectations than anger at everybody else for not fitting them. I think parents struggle with that. You know, I want Anya to be a Rhodes Scholar. She doesn't like school. She's never liked school. You know, sometimes I'm pretty upset about that. Other times I think, why are you carrying that expectation around? You know, where did that come from in you? So I'll tell you, you get confronted, you know. Anyway, what I, and then, you know, thinking about it, when we think about the government and how we want it to change, all of that, you know, what are our expectations? What are they representative of? What are the visions that we're operating out of? And like I said, next time we'll talk about vision. Okay, I know I'm just kind of dumping a lot of thoughts down, and I have a whole other set now where I just wanted to talk about feelings and the different kinds of feelings people have in reaction to all these things. Before I do that, I'd just like to check in with you to see if you're following me, and also if you have any responses to what I've said. Kind of blending them. I think there are differences between them, but I'm blending them in order to talk about that terrible feeling where we feel like hope has, we've abandoned hope and it's sapping our energy. That's basically what I'm talking about. I'm saying that often comes out of having expectations that don't get through.
But can we always lessen our expectations? What's the purpose then?
Mm-hmm. I hope I'm not giving the impression that expectations need to lessen. I think what I'm saying is that expectations can be held rigidly, so rigidly that we're not including the new information about life that might modify them, expand them.
What I was thinking about was the three D's. If you have such high expectations that they can never be met, you're going to be down here all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would. Sometimes we have what I label realistic expectations, and then we're disappointed when they don't get met. I mean, that's certainly true. But then I think, well, we know that, and we're prepared for the bad feelings when they need some kind of change and it hits us harder, it's when we're not prepared, it's when they might be held rigidly, when they don't quite match the new information. I'm bringing all of this up, I guess, as a way to recognize that if we make change, we're changing a lot. We're changing behavior, attitude, old ways of thinking, and feelings are going to come up. And they're healthy. They're right. They're saying something important.
Okay,
I feel like I'm losing.
No, it doesn't, and it doesn't fit where you're going, I assume. But it's true that expectations sometimes are met.
Yeah.
And there is joy.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Ideology fits, the personal stuff is never there, and that's
cool.
The satisfied life and moments of hope and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, just...
And that's great. Yeah. And yes, mm-hmm. thank God that happens. Mm-hmm. Also, Dorothy Day has, we have a card on one of our tables that says, her moments of most bitterness occur when things are good.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes when things are right, we have the space, the slack, to feel all the junk that comes in. Of course, it clears out, and then we've got
sure.
we've got the sunshine.
How do you deal with
stuff I have with, like with Anya, for instance, that, I mean, I think those, that grating that I feel or something like that's telling me something more about me than it's telling me about her.
Is there a difference between expectation and hope? That the expectation is more realistic? Maybe either.
There is,
too,
for me.
Good expectations, but do not hope.
Well, I'm saying we always have expectations, that we need to have expectations. We need to have visions of where we're going and of what life could be like. We always need those. I'm saying that sometimes they create problems for us, or we experience problems for them when they don't get met. And then we need to look at them, or we need to look at ourselves or something. We always need to have.
I was just going to suggest that maybe it's hope that makes being able to have expectations possible. From a faith position,
mm-hmm.
to the actual position.
Mm-hmm.
But the expectations change, but the hope doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds fun. Carolyn?
But in what Jim was saying, too, when. Is there a time when we, in our reassessment and reevaluation, that we shouldn't necessarily lower our expectations of, because our feelings tell us, I mean, maybe our expectation caused us pain. I'm thinking of education, that you often hear said, you know, don't lower your expectations for a student. Raise them, they will rise to meet those expectations. So I think it can go both ways. I mean, sometimes maybe it's wrong just because our expectations of someone that haven't been met has given us pain, but maybe we don't necessarily want to always lower them. Maybe instead we have to accept the pain and still keep the expectations up there because maybe eventually those expectations would be met. That's a little bit to do with what you said, or keep the hope there, but maybe the...
I think I know what you're talking about. It doesn't. Lowering expectations isn't even wouldn't be some the way I'd even talk about it. I would say modifying my vision, reevaluating my vision, reevaluating what I'm expecting to have happen, what I'm holding to. Particular attitude about a student. If I live out of continual disappointment with my expectation around that, there's something not matching. Something. Which doesn't mean that you don't have encouragement and belief that that person can do better. So I don't quite know how to talk about all of this. I wish Florida were here.
Keyword for me was when you said continue. It's always having stops, and it surely seems to me any great strong message. But I think sometimes when something doesn't happen quickly or whatever else, and on our timeline, it may be what you're saying.
And it may be that our reassessment needs to be to recognize that this isn't going to happen immediately as we'd like it to, or something. I mean, that can be a
Well, I'm just saying that message, that feeling is a message. That's not to deny. It takes me that far.
Not to deny the feeling.
Right.
And but we.
Did you hear that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, go ahead.
No.
If we use our feelings as a gauge to the timeline, I don't know, they can get pretty distorted. We're not always objective with our feelings. I don't know. No, but they can get kind of out of control.
Great, that's what I was going to talk about next.
Suzanne's bursting away.
Since we don't have a lot of time, I'll talk about it. Now! I think I've spent more time as a counselor helping people respect the feelings that go on inside of them and understand their feelings and educating them about the value of those feelings than I've done anything else. Probably I've been accepting of them and their feelings more than anything else. We have a lot of notions about feelings. If we begin to feel them, we'll go crazy. Or if we, somebody's so angry, they're, the top of their head's going to blow off. Right? Well, we have expressions about feelings that just are dire, and I think what that tends to do for most of us, now I know that there's some people that have sort of stronger pathologies, and I'm not going to be talking about them, but for those of us that function, move about the earth in daily patterns, our feelings are not to be frightened of, but they are fuel for action and for clear thinking. If we honor them, if we express them, if we pay attention to them, if we share them with others. If we don't share them, we feel isolated often. We feel we're the only person in the world who feels this way. We're the only person in the world who can do this job. We're the only person in the world who has plumbed the depths of this of despair this low. There's nobody who would understand. That happens to a society, even. And I think we're in a bit of the midst of that right now with the nuclear confrontation in front of us. We can feel isolated. We need to talk to each other about it. And I think sometimes we realize that if we start to open our mouths and say what it is we're feeling, people come out of the woodwork in response to that, either in support or even in confirmation that they've got the same feelings too. Our feelings, if we don't express them, often make us feel powerless because we're working so hard to not express them that that's where our energy is. Makes life feel futile. There's no point in doing anything anyway. And we need to share them so that we can remember those times when we felt effective in our lives, no matter how small, and start acting on them again. If we don't express our feelings, we also lose sight of our visions. And that's awfully disturbing to people. That looks like the loss of hope. The world won't change, I won't change, she won't change, he won't change. There's nothing. And I think we need to start talking out loud so those visions get recreated, they get real again, and we start to hear them. One reaction to, I don't quite know how to fit this in, except I just want to talk about guilt. It's a fairly common feeling. We all feel it from time to time. There's healthy guilt, which is the regret for not doing something that could have been done. And as we look in hindsight, it really should have been done. Would have really helped the situation. We feel natural regret, normal regret, healthy guilt. But we more often, I would bet, feel what I would call an unhealthy guilt, which is where we feel guilt or regret over something which we did not have total control. So to feel guilt that the legislature voted in a way that we didn't want them to vote is more guilt than we need to take on. It's guilt we don't need, because we had we did not have 100% control over that vote or whether a submarine it got built. For us to feel guilty about that is not so helpful, because we didn't have total control. Some of us feel guilt that we even have feelings, that we have feelings of despair, that we have feelings of anger. When the feelings start to come up, we feel guilty for having them. And so we add that on top of the feelings. And that's why I keep saying they're normal. We all have them. They're human fuel. And those of us that are religious sometimes think that if we have low feelings or angry feelings, that means that we're not trusting in God, we're not trusting the divine. How could we feel this way? We must be shaking in our faith. When I think you've studied for several weeks now with Original Blessing, I would say that to accept the darkness and face it is more of a choice of faith than anything. And anger is another feeling that we often have when expectations don't get met, when we try to make change. And anger is real good fuel. It just needs to be released. If it's not released, it eats away at your inside. So you've got to go around doing something with it. And there are real healthy, constructive ways to do something with anger. You can talk to somebody, you can shout, you can go for a run, you can spend that energy in some way or another. But to deny the anger is real unfortunate. I grew up in a family where if you expressed any angry feeling at all, it was labeled sassy or complaining. And certainly if you said you were mad, it was like, well, you're not. I mean, one isn't mad, so you don't use that word. So I never in my family ever did say anything or did anything. I didn't see anybody do anything. I mean, I remember going up to my room sometimes and sort of screaming into my pillow or something, but that was really rare. And I didn't let anybody know I did that. It was years after when I realized that I could be angry at somebody and tell them that, and they could, we could talk about it and somehow things were better. I never knew you could do that. What a relief. And so now I realize that there are times when I feel very complainy and I think, what's going on? And I go with it. I go to somebody and I start to complain and I get the wheels going, and before you know it, it's gone. So I figured something out. But I haven't lived with that not going anywhere. Feelings in general, we need to be gentle with ourselves about. And by gentle, I mean we need to respect them. Jan Bodine says we need to be peace lovers with ourselves. We don't need to be forceful and drive ourselves and pound ourselves in the head and say, don't feel this. We need to be peacemakers with that. We need to be peace loving. We need to say, what's going on here? Why am I feeling this way? This must be important. She says, dealing with despair focuses on the human being, not on the human doing. It's a part of human authenticity. We need to look at it. She calls it personal disarmament. And I call that hope. Can I give you homework? Or do you not do homework?
Two different things.
Listen to your tapes, right? Yeah, okay. Well, let me give you if I could make a couple of suggestions. Sure. Listen to a tape that you've been wanting to listen to around what you think around your life. some question about your life, because we're going to talk about visions next time. So please listen to one. The other thing is, this is what I would really give you as homework, if I could really facilitate it, I would do it with all of you, would be that if you could possibly spend 10 minutes between now and next Tuesday when we have our class expressing a feeling to somebody, I would love it. And by that I mean not a feeling about that person, but to have company while you express a feeling. So if you could spend 10 minutes, if you think you're angry right now, if you could spend 10 minutes actually being angry with somebody in their presence, I think it'd be wonderful. If you're feeling sad, if you could spend 10 minutes being sad, crying, whatever you need to do. Or if you're feeling afraid, if you could spend 10 minutes feeling that fear, shivering, whatever, with somebody. And I say with somebody in order to counter that isolation that we feel when we start to feel our feelings. Not for them to solve your problem, but to give us that kind of attention that we need. I'd really encourage you to do that. It might be you could just say, oh, I have a homework assignment, I need to cry for 10 minutes. Would you mind listening to me? Please don't solve my problems, please don't interrupt.